I'm back from Vegas. What's going on, fools? This is the QTR Podcast. Today is, I don't even know what day it is. This podcast is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that sign up and donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the podcast. My listeners and my kind friends, I'm going to shout them out, and then we are going to get started with today's interview, which I am stoked about. I'm stoked about all of them, though. You know why? Because I book all the guests. I do this podcast for me, folks, and if some of you want to come along in the process, I'm more than happy to have you, especially those who decide to throw money at me. I'm going to shout you guys out right now. It seems like a good time to do that. First and foremost, my friends over at The Trader's Path. TheTradersPath.com is a brand new investor education and investor advocacy service. It's great for day traders. You're going to get a live stream every day of what my friend Pete over at the Trader's Path is looking at and what he's doing on the daily. You'll get watch lists in the morning. You'll get investor education. And the whole purpose of the program, it was start up to avoid the nonsense and bullshit traders rooms that are out there during the day. We all know which ones they are. Of course, we're not going to mention them by name for legal reasons, but we will just say Peter has had enough, and so he decided to start the Trader's Path and is a kind supporter of the QTR podcast, aligning the no bullshit goal with me. It works out very well. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at the Sanglucci Steam Room. Sanglucci is a group of traders that focus primarily on steam in the options market. That means they are following the big money in the somewhat illiquid options market to try and telegraph where stocks are going to be headed in the short term and in the long term. It's a strategy that's worked out for them. They offer a master course, which is in the podcast description. They offer the 3LT playbook, which is the three rules that Lucci used to be able to sign our entire check for our pool cabana that we had at the Encore Resort last week. While we were sitting outside for fun in the sun, it was Grey Goose, it was Coronas. Mr. Lucci's doing very well. You may want to check out the 3LT playbook that he's got. The man parties in Puerto Rico, folks. I don't know what else to tell you. Also, this podcast brought to you by my friends over at RumorHound. RumorHound.ai is a brand new piece of AI-based software that is going to help you try to determine which rumors about mergers and acquisitions you see on the daily. Oftentimes they're reported in mainstream news. Sometimes they're reported on Twitter. Sometimes they're reported in chat rooms. Which of these you should probably pay attention to and which ones you should ignore. It has a proprietary algorithm that looks at things like the viability of these transactions, the financials behind each of the companies, and the credibility of the sources to try to help you determine which rumors you may want to pay attention to and which ones you may want to ignore. It's a great tool to have in your toolbox. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at Focused Compounding. Focused Compounding focuses on nothing more than the trade ideas that the market has not found yet. They look in niche areas to bring you opportunities that are not going to be covered in analyst reports and not going to be covered in the mainstream media. You can check them out on Twitter at Focused Compound, and you can check them out at FocusedCompounding.com. Those links are also in the podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Hell and Bacon that shoot machine guns out of helicopters. Some of my newest and best patrons, my friend Jameson Trinker, checked in a couple of days ago. I appreciate the shit out of you, my friend. My good friends over at Corvus Gold, my friend Monero is in the house. My buddy Jay Mintzmeyer checked in. Thank you, my friend, the shipping expert. Russell Valenti, saw you last week. Thank you for continuing to be a patron, my friend, and for your generous donation for charity. Matthew Zimmer, Nicholas Parks, Nathan Mishog, Chris Bede, Ken R., and Chris Boas. Folks, I want to tell you, together with Russ Valenti, we raised $1,000 for all of the causes at Traders for a Cause this year. So that's something to be proud of. And that doesn't happen if my Patreons don't come through and put the pedal to the metal when I ask for patrons. So thank you guys very much. It was nice to be able to give them a check. And thank you very much to Russ Valenti for coming in and matching what we raised by a matter of 4x to make it $1,000 donation that we made. Thank you guys so much. Some of my newest patrons I want to shout out also. My friend Antonio Bachlig just checked in. Gary Cottingham is still here. Jeffrey LaRiviere, what's going on, my brother? Stephen A. Clark is still here. I appreciate you. Gary Wozniak making a contribution that I appreciate very much. Thank you, my friend. Jay checked in. My friend Collins Davis is now in the house. Creighton Titus and Dennis King Cambo and Stephen Hemingway. Thank you guys so much. And some of my older patrons, Jonathan Elliott, Burn Necessities, my friend Jonathan Faith, Daniel Rust, James Currian. Thank you guys so much. Glenn Tung, I saw you in Vegas. Great to see you in person, my friend. Chi-Chi's from the Coconut, still in the house with Jerry Baker, Colin Turner, and my friend Max motherfucking Mulvihill. All right, two more things. This podcast, especially today's, requires a two-drink minimum. You may want to do it up Hefner style, motherfuckers. Get the bathrobe out. Get the bottle of Quo Vadis cognac out, because you're talking to the ladies, man. No, we're instead going to be talking to Charlie Bathgate from Sanlucci. Wait till you hear what this guy has to say. I've talked to him once in my life. I've found him extraordinarily fascinating. So stoked to have him on. Nothing that we are about to say is financial advice or life advice. So if you wind up trapped in the middle of the woods, hooked on psychedelic mushrooms, and broke, it's not our fault. On the line with me today, Charlie Bathgate, the international man of mystery from Sanlucci.com and WallStreetJesus.com. Charlie Bathgate, ladies and gentlemen, is where my stock market friends mix with my psychedelic drug using friends. There's a fucking Venn diagram there, and in the middle, there's a little smiling picture of Charlie Bathgate's face. What's going on, man? Brother?
Love that. I love the honor of that. Not much, man. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I am a little hungover still from Las Vegas. Have you talked to Lucci since he's been back?
All I got, we haven't really caught up. All I got was that he had a blast, that you're training for a fight. Is that right? A competition?
Yeah, jiu-jitsu tournament, November 3rd. All right.
We got to talk about that for sure.
Well, I wasn't doing much training while I was out there.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine so. But I heard it was a great time, man. He's continuing with the Lucci Meat stuff out there, which is going really well for him. And I know he got to hang out with some crazy assholes like yourself. So that's always a good thing.
Yeah, and I got to meet, I think, some of the people that follow you guys as well. I don't know if they're clients or if they're fans or supporters, but right. Hung out with some really cool dudes. This guy Lennox, I don't know if you know him. There was another gentleman whose name's escaping me right now. I'm sorry, I don't even know what day it is. But yeah, we all wound up going out to dinner, going out to the clubs together. We had a gentleman named Brandon. It was just really an awesome time.
I recognize some of these names.
Lucci was in good form too, man. He looked good.
Of course.
He picked up the tab at the pool cabana. You know? I got like no complaints about the trip, man.
He's doing that a little bit more these days. That's what happens when you get closer to enlightenment and add another zero to your bank account, you know?
Yeah, but, I would encourage him to stay enlightened, especially when we're out drinking together.
That's awesome.
Speaking of enlightenment, what is going on in your world? So for the listener, and really, Charlie, this is the first time I've talked to you in probably a year. We talked about a year ago. It's the only time we've ever talked before. I called you to talk about business, and we wound up in a two-hour conversation about psychedelics. And I was like, I'm so pissed I'm not recording this. So here we are today, and we're recording it. So what's going on in your world? What do you do?
What do I do, man? I could ask that a good bit. First and foremost is running Sanlucci.com, WallStreetJesus.com. So running everything that we do. Lucci and I are partners on things. Wall Street Jesus partner on everything. And I'm the one in the background, you know, making it, setting things up so that everyone in our community can keep doing what they're doing and trading and, supporting Lucci and Jesus as they're out there doing all the stuff that they do, managing the team. We're about to make a big investment into our platform that we have, which is exciting, but that's a lot of work. So, doing that, that's a good portion of my day to day. And then the other portion of what I do is some consulting right now to organizations, either for-profit or nonprofit, that are in like the mental health or psychedelic space. So I work with a couple different groups, just kind of like helping them find their way around various problems, things that I have a little bit of experience in that they don't. So that's really fun. That takes up some time. And then I'm applying for graduate school to get a master's in psychology so that I can be a licensed psychotherapist and work with psychedelics once they're legalized. We want to do that for traders, want to do that for entrepreneurs, people from all walks of life. So been doing a good bit of
You think it's inevitable that psychedelics become legalized?
I don't want to jinx it, and I don't want to go so far as to say inevitable, but I think it's we are steamrolling down that path. Legalize is one thing. Medicalize will certainly happen before, sure, broader legalization. But yeah, I mean, there's the fastest thing that's happening right now is the use of MDMA to treat PTSD.
Right.
And that looks like it could be medicalized as early as like 2021. They're doing phase 3 clinical trials for that right now, which is just like incredibly exciting. And then there's all, like, I live in Oakland now, and they just decriminalized psychedelics. Same thing with Denver, which is where I'm from. So it's also coming from that end too of decriminalization. Definitely riding the wave of the cannabis, all that momentum. So it's happening, man.
It feels like every time I read about MDMA, every time I read about psychedelics for medicinal use, the results are always astonishing. Every time there's an article or something that comes across that, and there's been a peppering of them over the last couple of years for, like you're saying, MDMA and PTSD and all these other uses, the results look astonishing. And I mean, am I to believe that in the 70s, when this type of testing and things with LSD started, that they were having the, similar profound results, but eventually it just became, the war on drugs, and then all drugs equal bad? I mean, of course, unless it has fucking Pfizer stamped on it. Right, and then they basically threw this shit out and said, we don't care if it works. It's making people see things and pretend that they're hallucinating, that they're Abraham Lincoln or whatever. And so we'll just put it in the no column. Is that what happened?
I mean, yeah, actually the research with it and the use in a medical setting started, you could go all the way into shamanistic and that sort of territory, but in like sort of Western scientific world, really starting like the 1950s, and it had showed incredible promise, LSD, then they started using psilocybin, so mushrooms. Once they synthesized MDMA using that was used, I believe that was like mid to late 70s, and it showed ridiculous promise. Yeah. And it was a cultural, it was a political, turn of events that caused things to be illegal. I mean, there were definitely sort of outlier situations where they could be leveraged in media or politically, people who took way too much in the wrong settings and had shitty experiences, which can absolutely happen with psychedelics. They're not like a panacea. They can really mess you up if you use them the wrong way. People pointed to those in reality and created this sort of narrative around you're going to have bad trips. They're going to make you insane. I mean, growing up, right, for me in the 90s, the DARE education was like, if you take LSD, it's going to get stuck in your spinal cord and you could just have like a psychotic break at any moment. It's not true. All the resurgence of research that's happened now has really been overturning a lot of those misunderstandings around psychedelics. And then there's all these people who are out there who, I mean, I was helping run an organization for a while that provided content and education around psychedelics, and I would talk to a lot of people who were interested in them coming to them. And they were coming because like nothing else was working for them. They've been through everything, like, right, just what we were talking about, Pfizer pharmaceuticals, all sorts of different interventions, and they were like, nothing fucking works. And psychedelics can work for some people in the right settings. So
yeah, it's one of those things that is not widely available. So if the usual suspects aren't working, you know, maybe it's time to get some neurons firing that that normally wouldn't be firing. You know what I mean? Dust off a part of your brain and turn the fucking circuit board on for a minute and see if you can jar anything loose. Of course, that is not a medical opinion, nor is anything that I say here.
I mean, likewise, same goes for me. But you're right. I mean, they're understanding now. They can put people who take LSD in an fMRI and they can see, like, holy shit, it actually does light up parts of the brain.
Oh, yeah. It's like the 4th of July, right?
Yeah, and it shuts down parts of the brain that are usually too active, which, you know, have a negative impact on us. And it causes parts of the brain to communicate that wouldn't otherwise communicate. So, yeah, I mean, going back to what you were saying earlier, it really was – it was a cultural thing, and it was a political backlash. I mean, there's – if you want to go deep into sort of the conspiracy theory
– yes.
Conspiracy theory, but no – not even necessarily conspiracy. Like, there's pretty widespread documentation around the Nixon administration – essentially just saying this stuff is, we need a way to put hippies and people who are, you know, in the anti-war movement and you know, working against our administration, we need to be able to criminalize them. And we certainly don't want people out there taking substances that are going to expand their perception of themselves, the role that they, you know, what role the government should have in their lives, you know, questioning things. So I mean, one of the things they did was put a target on the back of Timothy Leary and say, he's public enemy number one. We're going to put him on a pedestal. We're going to make an example out of him. We're going to chase him. They literally chase him throughout the entire world. I mean, it's totally insane, the vendetta that they had against this guy. And not to say that everything Timothy Leary did was great, because it's not. But yeah, they really weaponized it, and they used it as a way to criminalize anybody who was doing anything that was working against the administration. So that was a huge part of it. And then, you know, you get into the war on drugs, which is a whole different, you know, can of worms, but I think is pretty widely being recognized right now as a colossal failure. And there was just a ton of fear mongering around the use of these drugs. You pick up one story and you say, you know, some kid took some MDMA and drank 6 gallons of water, and ergo we should make them illegal. And had a hugely detrimental impact on our culture, I think. So,
yeah, it reminds me of all the old marijuana commercials, like the ones they parodied. And I think there was a parody of one in Half Baked, you know, where the kids are like, they get a little high and they're like, oh, let's check out dad's gun, you know, and then
right. They
put the gun in their mouths. It's like, actually, it's not what's going on in my house when people are getting high, all right? I'm sorry. We're
right. Mostly
eating macaroni and cheese out of giant bowls and
right. Putting
the headphones on and turning the volume up full blast, watching the same fucking YouTube live performance I've been watching for, you know, 10 years of my favorite band.
Right. And
still finding right. New shit in it, too, you know?
Right, like, man, exactly.
Fucking 10 right. Years I've been listening to this concert, and I never heard the bass line like this before. This is incredible.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's another thing that's happened is there's a lot of people who've had experiences with these drugs now, psychedelics, weed, whatever it is, it's a lot like the, you know, like civil rights movement for gay rights. That there's a lot of overlap between that. And there was all this stigma out there for a long time about negative stigmas about people who are gay and things that narratives about that were just not true. And then over time, as more people came out and people were not gay, started to look around and be like, wait, I know this guy, Tim, who's gay, and he's a great dude. He's a normal guy. What the fuck is all this? There's all this bullshit that I've been sold about gay people about. Like, this is wrong.
I thought you were going to say because you see a lot of rainbow colors when you're tripping.
right. That can happen. If that happens, you might, you know, you need to ask yourself some questions, which right. Is okay.
Well, people are talking about it more, right? That's what you're saying, essentially, right?
Yeah, exactly. They call it coming out of the psychedelic closet, right? So then as you know people who do these things and who have positive experiences and, you know, it's helped them in a lot of ways, some of them ways you'd expect and some of them ways you wouldn't, then people just, it changes their perception of them. And that's really important. So
All I know is your business partner went to Costa Rica, drank a bunch of ayahuasca, and then came to Las Vegas and paid the check at a pool cabana. That's all I know. So that's a positive experience with psychedelics.
Yes, absolutely. How about that, man? I mean, your guys' podcast was awesome. I mean, I've heard a lot of people talk about psychedelics and their experiences, and researchers, psychiatrists, whoever it is, and you guys went into some stuff that people just don't often talk about in these experiences, like the whole thing of him getting bit by the dog outside of the waterfall with his Jeep, and really looking at that and having that be this moment of self-reflection for him, and you know how he's a fight, he brought it upon himself, and he's a fighter too much in his life. I was like, damn, people just don't talk about this stuff.
Yeah, we went deep on that one. If you haven't heard that podcast, go back. It's, I don't know what number it is, but if you look up Quote the Raven and then Sang Lucci, the ayahuasca podcast, it's back. It's probably like 20 or 30 podcasts back. But, you know, I think that's part of the problem in general. I think you make a really good point that the more people kind of talk about this stuff, the more it becomes okay, like you're saying. People kind of come out of the psychedelic closet. I think, you know, a lot of this can be traced back to content and where content comes from. Like, content used to come from ABC, CBS, NBC, and a couple other television stations. Now content comes from all across the internet. And, you know, the number one podcast in the world is the Joe Rogan podcast, and he's constantly talking about psychedelics. He constantly has, you know, Graham Hancock on. He constantly has, what's his name, McKenna's brother on there. He's got another guy in there that just fucking stares at mushrooms all day. I mean, you know...
Right. So you're absolutely right.
I think he's broadening a lot of horizons. And to be honest with you, as somebody that had experimented with hallucinogens and, you know, may or may not be done experimenting with hallucinogens during the course of my life, it was refreshing to hear that stuff because, you know, my personal experiences didn't line up with the, you know, 1990s DARE commercials. And so I think the more it kind of, again, we're not offering medical advice here, and I did disclaim this whole podcast at the beginning by saying if you wind up broke and out in the woods hallucinating, it's not our fault. But I can speak from personal experience that it's an interesting feeling, you know, when Lucci talks about one of the things that we tapped on, as I'm sure you know, was the surrendering of the ego, which is something that, you know, I try to think about every day. I try not to bring my ego with it. Ego is just, it'll kill you. It'll just it'll hurt you in every aspect of your life. And this awareness that some people get from psychedelics of, as you said, becoming enlightened, questioning not only the government, but questioning themselves, questioning their purpose in life, questioning everybody's purpose in life as a whole. It's that type of deep, deep thinking that allows you to affect change in a big way. And it would be easy to understand why the Nixon administration wouldn't want you to do that, because nobody's focused on, you know, getting up and going to work at General Electric in the morning when they're staring into a woman with, you know, 16 arms that's telling you she's the god of the sun. You're like, fuck, I better figure out this sun god thing first before I go in for my morning meeting.
Right. Well, that's one of the things that is really interesting to me about microdosing now, is because you're having people who, and again, not endorsing anybody make any decisions based just on this conversation.
Yeah,
right?
Don't microdose. It sucks. With that said, never, keep going.
Never do it. But people are experiencing psychedelics for different purposes in different ways, and they're experiencing them in the context of work, right? And there's an interesting backlash because they really took off in Silicon Valley in the tech world, as a replacement for like ADD medications and stimulants and stuff. Right. And there's all these coders who were microdosing because they felt like, okay, it helps me actually focus for longer. It doesn't have a lot of like the shitty physiological impact of an amphetamine.
Right.
It also helps me think more creatively and stuff. And that's great. Right. So people were microdosing. It got really popular. There was a lot of backlash in the psychedelic community of people saying, well, now psychedelics are just going to be leveraged as this like tool for capitalism, right? So we just look at America, look how fucked up it is. All we do is just take, you know, any substance, even things that are considered sacred by many cultures, and we just make it into this thing that can help you make more money, right? Because that's how poisoned our culture is. And like, there are shades of truth to that, right? I'm not going to argue that our culture doesn't have serious problems. But my perspective on it was, it's really fascinating to see people engaging with psychedelics and taking them in the context of experiencing their work. Because like, if we step back for a second and think about, would I rather have a bunch of people going to their jobs and taking amphetamines and just sort of blindly like cranking on whatever is in front of them and not thinking about themselves in a larger context, not questioning themselves, not getting in greater touch with sense of empathy and thinking about how other people in the room,
doing stupid things a lot faster.
Right, exactly. Just doing stupid things a lot faster, not even really thinking about what's happening. Or would I rather have people going and you know, taking a microdose, like a pretty much innocuous dose of psychedelic, and saying, and then going through and doing their work, but potentially, like, the odds that that person who's doing that is going to reflect on themselves and what they're doing in a more meaningful way, that's so much higher, you know, than someone who's just like guzzling whatever, coffee and other means of, you know, performance enhancement. So I tend to look at it as more of a good thing. And it's interesting. I mean, I know a lot of people who have taken who've microdosed, and they haven't necessarily gone in and told their boss to go fuck themselves and, you know, gone off into an ashram in the woods. But they have said, like, all right, I think I've realized over the next 6 months, maybe I want to transition, or I actually love my job, I'm going to stay here, but I'm going to change how I relate to this guy who sits next to me because he's driving me crazy every day and I got to control what I can control and not his behavior, you know, that kind of subtle stuff. So it's interesting. It's interesting now people are using psychedelics in very different ways and in different contexts. Whereas before, I think it was just like very much associated with radical, you know, hippie movement and festivals and stuff like that.
It was a huge, and there's a big difference between microdosing and, you know, eating 15 mushroom caps out in a field somewhere.
Extremely different.
I'm not an expert on the pharmacokinetics, the physiological effect, whatever the fuck you want to call it. But when you're microdosing, you know, instead of going full on balls out hallucinating, you're just kind of gently tapping these, I don't know how it works, but you're just kind of gently tapping into these neurons or whatever it is that has, you know, just gently kind of pushing on some boundaries instead of going full scale, you know, 1 minute I'm at work and next minute I'm in a 1970s remake of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is not where you want to be in the middle of a board meeting, you know, especially when the board of trustees is in town. Bill, I don't know what's wrong with him over there.
he's eating the annual report right now. I think we need to remove him from his post.
Oh, there goes the MIT grant. God damn it. Who hired this asshole?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're taking a microdose, it's supposed to be a sub-perceptual dose, right? So you're not, there's no visual distortions. You're not seeing anything that isn't there. You're totally in control of your thoughts. I mean, nobody, let's just say this. I've had a lot of conversations. I've had a lot of engagements with people while microdosing, and there is no way that they had any idea.
Did you microdose today?
I can't really comment on that.
Well, you might as well just maybe, fucking say yes.
yes, of course. Yes, I did. Actually, I'm in Oakland. It's decriminalized. Yes, I did.
Oh, all right.
Yes, I did. So, yeah, and it's
and nothing,
it's so
nothing crazy
subtle.
Is happening. I don't sound like Woody Woodpecker or something, do I?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, no more than usual, I guess. But No. It's extremely subtle. I mean, the only way I change my behavior really when I do it is I just drink less like coffee, you know, it's stimulating. So you don't really need that, but so it's not like messing you up. You know, what people typically associate with a psychedelic experience, you're really not having that at all when you microdose. And that's one of the benefits of it, because you can like integrate it more into your life. I mean, we've talked about this a little bit. We talked about in the conversation that we had. I enjoy psychedelics a lot. I like doing them, but I can't really do them more often than like maybe, like I'm talking larger doses, maybe once every 2 to 3 months, you know, because they're just heavy. It's a lot. Like you're physically, it can be a little bit exhausting, but it's, you know, you're just, there's so much thrown at you in terms of insight and introspection, and there's so much to like chew on and work with. And it's not, that's one of the reasons they're not addictive. Like you don't go, most people don't go right. take a bunch of LSD and then wake up the next day. You're like, I want to do that again. Like, let's right. do that. Let's hit the reset button on that. You know, it's not what happens. So
I think every 2 to 3 months is already, I think that's way too often.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot. Yeah. It's a good amount. And there's no way, it sounds like when you take it, sometimes you're taking really big doses.
No, I was just fucking around, but I made that example okay. before.
Right. Got you.
No, with everything else, as with everything else, I try to be modest, and I try to do everything in moderation, you know, in serious moderation, because what you're presented with is so profound, you know, like Lucci is figuring things out today about going into the woods and drinking ayahuasca that he didn't even realize was happening then, or didn't realize was happening a month or two after when I spoke to him. He's probably still having revelations about it.
Yeah,
you
know, exactly.
I still think about, you know, certain times and certain insights that I've had, and kind of how your analysis of them and how you interpret them and what you take away from them evolves over time, right?
Yes, totally. Yeah, that's a huge thing in terms of, I mean, they call it integration, but it's like, I've had experiences where I went in and say, you know, say I take mushrooms. I'm like, okay, I really want to think about, you know, my relationship to myself in this regard in a certain way. Right. And I go in and I take it, and then it's like nothing at all like that. And I'm sitting in the experience. I'm like, what the fuck, man? I thought I was going to get some insight about this thing, and I'm going in a completely different direction. But then a week later, 2 weeks later, or a month later, as I think about things and you know, think back on it more, I'm like, oh my God, I'm realizing how so much of that experience was actually about what I was thinking about, what I wanted to sort of look into, but it happened in a way that it unfolded in a way that I just didn't understand at the time, or that was a little bit too complex for my, you know, dumb ass to realize what, you know, really what was happening. So yeah, it takes time, and then you walk away with all these lessons and these things that you want to apply to your life. But that's the beginning. You gotta apply it to your life. You gotta do the work. You have to translate it, and that, you know, that takes work. That takes time. So
it's strange. Yeah. There's this point, just as with anything else. So if you've never taken hallucinogens, you've probably had a drink before. You've probably smoked pot before. There's a point where you just set off in one direction, and it's not necessarily, like you said, how you plan it. You can control some things, right? You can you can control your surroundings. You can control who you're with. You can control the mood you're in when you sit down to have that first beer, or you sit down to smoke the joint, or you sit down to, you know, microdose or whatever. But there is, to me, I've always experienced that there's this point where you're going to be taken in one direction kind of whether or not you like it or not. And I've had that yeah. feeling with alcohol. I've had it with, you know, I've had it with marijuana. I've had it with hallucinogens. Like you said, you prepare yourself to go in one way and say, all right, well, today I'm going to find something super profound out about myself and how I treat other people. And an hour later, you're just watching an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, wondering like why people's faces are melting off, and vice versa. You know, some days you sit down and you're like, wow, you know, this is super trippy. I'm going to go down to the city at night and see what happens. And instead you wind up sitting in a corner in a bar for 6 hours contemplating the meaning of life. I mean, it happens, right? So you just kind of have to remember to kind of ride that wave and not let that wave ride you, and kind of surrender a little bit going in, knowing that you're relinquishing some control
Totally.
Is really the best way that I can describe it. The biggest panic attacks I've had, you know, whether the very first panic attack I ever had, I was stoned. I was skateboarding. I was stoned. I was in college. We had these longboards, Charlie. We used to, me and a bunch of other skateboarders, they had just paved Westchester, where I went to college, the whole town. And we would gather around on a Tuesday or something, or a Thursday, whenever we had class the next day. And we would pass around the old tobacco pipe. And then we would take our longboards out and we would go glide down the smooth streets of Westchester. And the first panic attack I ever had in my life was because I was high and I didn't know I was high. And I didn't know what being high felt like, didn't feel like, what it was supposed to feel like, what it could feel like when it, you know, went the wrong way, what it could feel like when it went the right way.
That was the first time you'd ever been high?
No, it wasn't. No. But it was the first time maybe I had ever been that high, or maybe I had ever experienced the feeling that I had. I just had a moment where I was skateboarding. I was going down a long hill. I was just coasting, just chilling out. And I remember I lost like 2 seconds. I just spaced out for like 2 seconds. And, you know, years later, if something like that would happen, it's a simple solution. I tell myself, you're high, and this is what happens when you're high. Like, this is the point of getting stoned, right?
Right.
But then it was like, well, I'm dying. I know this. I know what's going on here. First, it'll be 2 seconds I lose. Then at some point, I'm going to, you know. And the fucked up thing was, I wasn't even worried about dying. I was worried about crashing the skateboard in the middle of the road and holding up traffic. That was the first thing I thought.
It's about these other people, right? I might shatter my femur, but hold up traffic. This guy might be late.
Right.
5 minutes late to this meeting. So
you never.
My God.
You never really know. You know, kind of which direction you go out. Hey, I'm going to have one drink. And then all of a sudden you're 3 drinks deep and you feel like dancing, you know, like there's some type of intangible that just whisks you away. You're at the behest of the substance, whatever it is at that point. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's always a letting go process. Every single time I do it, there's always a moment where I'm like, oh shit. I am not in control of this experience. Right. And then when I say do it, I mean larger doses. And that's terrifying, man. People don't want to be out of control. Who wants to be out of control? That's like, we build our lives around control. We have routines because it gives us a sense of control.
Right.
We gather resources and money and everything because, like, I want to be in control, my own destiny. When things happen to us that we didn't see coming, that's terrifying, and we're hardwired to feel that. So that's part of, I think, one of the experiences that I enjoy the most, that I get the most out of it, is kind of crossing that threshold and, you know, I guess seeing what's on the other side of when you let go of control and seeing how I'm going to react to that experience, because each time it's a little bit different. It's like, it's a little bit like a, you know, testing yourself a little bit and seeing how you can deal with that, because the reality is, how much control do we all really have in our lives? Not nearly as much as you think that you do. And so I really look at it as, in some ways, it's like preparation. You know, it's
sure.
These things could happen, come out of nowhere at any given time. Might as well, you know, get used to that. Feel what
it's
like.
And the more you fight it, if you're caught by surprise. If you're at a, if you, I'm not saying this ever happened to me, but if you're at a UB40 concert, and town that rhymes with Philadelphia, stick with me. And a friend of a friend has, you know, a pen, and you've never smoked out of a pen before, and you try to hit it like you would a normal bowl, you know, with some gusto, if you will.
Yep.
And then you go inside and are taken back and a bit surprised at how interesting you feel some moments later. If you try to fight that, you're done. You have to just, you know, and it's the same with, it's the same with hallucinogens. If you're gonna take a healthy dose, you're going to get high. You know, you're going to hallucinate.
You know? You're going to lose control, man. Yeah, right. you're going to lose control, and that's okay.
You have to have a grip on how much control you want to lose, how much you want to surrender, like you're talking about microdosing versus whatever. But if you fight it, you're doing yourself a huge disservice because you're going to make things exponentially worse. And I think everybody has figured that out the hard way. I know I did. Did you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Tell me about a time when you really fucking panicked.
Oh man. All right, we can go there. I had an experience. I was actually doing mushrooms alone, and because I was like, I had some stuff around my dad, my relationship to my dad, that I really wanted to explore. My like mental health. My dad is a trader and he's an entrepreneur. So that's like the whole way that I met Lucci. That's the reason I'm even in this, you know, world to begin with. My dad and I were extremely close growing up, and we still are. And he had a lot of mental health issues, many of which are, you know, related to or impacted by his life as a trader, even though he's a really good trader. So I took mushrooms and I was kind of going full on borderline therapy mode, right? So I had eye shades on, I had, you know, music in, and I was like, you know, I want to go inwards. And right. they start surging, they start coming on. In the beginning, I actually felt really positive and, you know, this excitement about the journey, what was about to happen. And then I found myself in this cave, essentially, is how I would describe it. And I felt very small. I felt like I was a kid. And in hanging from this, it was like a dark, I wouldn't say hell, but it was not the kind of cave that you want to find yourself in. And
it wasn't a Buffalo Wild Wings.
yeah, that's a good way to put it. And hanging from the ceiling was this giant organ. It sort of looked like a hybrid of a heart and a lung and a liver, all sort of like mixed together. And it was like pulsing, and it was alive. It had these like black veins on the outside of it. It looked essentially evil. And then I realized, and I'm just sitting in there in this cave, and I was like, what did I just do to myself? What, like, where am I? This is horrible. This feels horrible. Get me out. I don't want to be in this situation. Yeah. Like, where's the fucking exit to this cave? And there was no exit. I couldn't really move. I couldn't get out of there. And I had set the intention before, like, whatever comes up, no matter how sort of gnarly it gets, I'm gonna stick with it. So, I realized as I sat there and as I kind of like gathered my shit and like focused on my breathing a little bit and calmed down a little bit, I was like, okay, there's a feeding tube. There's a tube at the top of this weird organ that's hanging there, and it's a feeding tube, and this thing is being fed. And I realized that giant organ was a metaphor for fear, right? A source of fear. And I was like, this thing has to be fed by something. It's not just existing on its own. It has to be fed by something. And in that moment, everything kind of shifted, and I wasn't the actual fear of the situation was really undercut and taken away. And I kind of changed my whole relationship to fear in that context. Cause I was just like, it's just a thing. It doesn't have a mind of its own or intention of its own. It's just this sort of life force, and it has to be fed by something. And I choose what to feed it. So, you know, this is very much these situations are my own making. I can determine that. And it's not like this thing has a life force of its own. I'm the creator of it. And then I got out of the cave. I thought about a bunch of other stuff. But certainly the beginning of that experience was really unpleasant. It was not great.
Just coming to the realization that you couldn't get out.
Yeah, just coming to the realization that I couldn't get out. That I had a couple moments where I was like, I'm totally unprepared for this. What, you know, I don't want to look at the shit that's deep in the recesses of my mind. Mm-hmm. That's one thing I get. That's one thing I get from people sometimes who are really have no experience with psychedelics. And they say, like, I don't want to go deeper into my thoughts. Like, I don't want to see the shit that's in my head. And I like respect that, but I've always, I guess, been really fascinated by what goes on in my head, what drives other people. And it's so, you can just go so deep. Like, there's just so much terrain to travel. It's kind of like this giant amusement park that we've all got in our heads. And I've always just been surprised by people who don't really want to explore that, you know? So, but in that moment, I was like, I'm way overhead, way in front of my skis here. Like, wow. I can't handle the situation.
People like control, like you said earlier. People like, yes, to get up and get trapped in their routine. People like the fact that their day is scheduled from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. And to some degree, there's an appeal to that. There's an appeal to feeling as though you have control, when really it's just, it's the illusion of control is what it is. Right. And your first, you know, the reason that I tried mushrooms for the first time ever was because specifically exactly what you're talking about, which is I wanted to judge for myself. I didn't want to take, and especially something like this, where everybody you talk to has a profound experience, whether it's good or bad, but oftentimes indescribable either way. And yep. So you don't really know until you do it. It's very difficult to, you know, it can be difficult to understand why people would want to go there to begin with. But really, in essence, it's stepping outside the snow globe of your head a little bit. And instead of being on the inside where it just feels like the snow's falling, you look on the outside and you kind of get a chance to see the hand that's kind of waving the globe around a little bit, you know. Or
that's a very good way to put it. Yes. Yeah.
You know, you can, what does he say in The Matrix? See how far the rabbit hole goes, right?
Right.
But
right.
I mean, there's a lot of similarities there. And I think it takes, I think you have to be sufficiently motivated to find some type of deeper answers and general enlightenment, whether good or bad, to want to go down that path at any point, especially understanding now, you know, the power of what hallucinogens can do. And then, you know, people that like yourself that want to go back there, you know, maybe in 2 months, 6 months, a year, maybe in tiny little micro doses, but you realize the value of it, you know, in addition to the things that can go wrong and the things that can fuck you up. And there are some, you know, but...
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, yeah, I think...
It's like overclocking a fucking CPU, right? Right. It's like, I got my Pentium i7 and it's running at 100%. It's like, what happens when I overclock it to 105? Like, I can get a lot more work done, but, you know, I do risk kind of blowing a head gasket at some point, and, you know, and then it becomes, how far do you want to overclock yourself? Or you could argue that we're already all underclocked to some degree, right? And that maybe we're only operating, catching 65% of what we should be catching, and that this moves us closer to 100%. What do you think?
I think that the... One of the things that they are seeing with psychedelics that they help you with, I mean, like sort of extending this metaphor of a computer, is that it is like a neurological reboot. And that it sort of resets various systems within your brain in what almost all of the research is showing is a very positive way. I think that it does give you extra capacity, but not necessarily in the same sort of linear way that your mind, your brain usually work. So, I mean, one of the things that it does is it creates more, it facilitates more divergent thinking, which is like creative thought, right? Like out of the box. This is actually one of the reasons why I think a lot of people, in finance and traders are drawn to it and can benefit from it. Like it helps you see things slightly, you know, slightly differently. And part of that is because of the neurophysiology of what's actually happening in your brain, and parts of your brain that communicate with one another typically wouldn't. And then there's a part of your brain that's called the default mode network, which is essentially where they think your sense of self originates from. Apologies to any sort of like neuroscientist that's out there listening to this. It's just like wants to murder me for butchering half of these explanations, but basic, like that's one of the places where they feel like your sense of self originates from. And when you take a psychedelic, in larger doses, it can actually sort of shut that default mode network off. So you lose your sense of self, which helps you gain an enormous amount of clarity on actually yourself, on your environment, on the forces that are influencing you in your life. And in microdoses, it does that on a much, on a much smaller level. So I think that it does sort of increase your capacity in that regard. But I also think, in terms of like pushing your computer into overdrive a little bit, I think in larger doses, it might, obviously that's not something you could sustain. It's not,
right.
You can be in that state and interact and, interface with the rest of the world on a consistent basis. It's just not possible. But I do think like the metaphor of overdrive is, I wouldn't go as far as to say that, because I feel like they're actually very healthy from a neurological perspective. So it's not like you're going to burn your machine out. Although I guess if you take them,
overdrive would be more would be more like amphetamines, probably, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like right. You're just grinding something
versus
too hard.
Versus just increasing your efficiency.
It's almost like you put a little genius gnome into the computer and was like, "Hey, put some different connect this wire here and put this here and blah 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 and like see what happens." And then,
right.
Your computer all of a sudden acts like a transformer or whatever, something completely different. Yeah, I guess that's how it would be. And I also think it's important, like a lot of times when people talk about psychedelics, it's easy and the unexpected. A lot of that is brought up in the context of a really of challenging experiences, right? Of like what are called bad trips. Right. And certainly that can happen. But I've also had a lot of experiences and been with a lot of people when they've had experience where they had incredibly positive things come out of the unexpected. And that's one of the lessons that I've drawn from it too, is like when you let go of control, you totally change what the positive, it completely blows the top off of what can happen in a positive way, because the stories that you tell yourself on a daily basis of here's what a good day would look like for me.
Right.
If you wake up and you say, this is what a good day would look like for me, I would go, my boss would say, I did a good job with this, eat a really good lunch, have some sex probably, like these things that are just naturally what you think of. But what really could happen on a really good day is something that is completely outside of your conception of what could even be possible.
Right.
And when you like let go of that sense of control and just start, riding the wave of whatever you're on, that can be incredibly positive and empowering thing to experience in a psychedelic state and like bring that out into the rest of your life.
I've heard stories that, I've had friends that have quit drinking after doing psychedelics. I have, it gets you out of that pattern, like you're saying.
Yes.
It's the difference between putting your computer to sleep and coming back and waking it up where it's 2 seconds and all the applications are still open versus actually going to the computer itself, the box, and hitting the power button and holding it for a hard shutdown where when you reset, fucking everything's gonna come up blank.
That's a perfect metaphor for it.
It can break you out of not just those types of patterns, but like you're saying, on a larger level, what is normal? What is a good day? What is a bad day? What is there really to be afraid of? What is there really not? Where's the meaning really going to come from in your day? It resets all of those, and then as you kind of reintroduce yourself back to whatever reality, if you want to call it that, you know, you recalibrate all of those things. And
And if you want to, open up the computer again and open up all the same windows, like, you can do that. You know, that's fine. But if you want to go in completely different directions, you can also do that. But you're making a conscious choice, and you have a much greater degree of self-awareness of what you're going to do. And the behavioral
– Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the behavioral change aspect to it. I think, like, for Lucci and I, what we do with coaching with Wall Street Jesus, you know, educating traders, and all my experience with myself and working with other entrepreneurs, being in, like, working in organizations that, are working around mental health. I mean, the hardest thing to do is to change human behavior.
Right.
It's so hard for us to change. And that is, like, addictions and smoking. That is how we eat. That is all, you know, from the big things that you immediately think about down to small things of, like, you know, something that could be relatively harmful. I'm trying to think of something that you don't even think about that much on a daily basis, but you do it, and it is a little bit detrimental to you. You know, you eat an extra
donuts.
Yeah, or not even that, but, like, you eat an extra 30% of food. Like, you hit a point when you're eating, when you're full, when you don't eat anymore. But then you eat another 25%, which I do all the time. And you just start, like, psychedelics can facilitate you being able to become so much more aware of those things. But also, it actually makes, it facilitates neuroplasticity. So it makes it so it's actually easier for you to change your behavior. So I notice it in really small levels. Like, if I'm microdosing on a somewhat consistent basis, usually I do the sort of normal protocol that people do is you do one day on, 2 days off, one day on, right? So if you microdose on a Saturday, you would take Sunday and Monday off, and then you microdose again, you know, on a Tuesday. So if I'm doing that kind of protocol, I notice slight changes in my ability to just do things differently. For example, my wife is an incredible cook, and I, you know, for the, like, whatever, 6 years of our relationship, I was basically dead weight in that department. I pretty much did not cook. And if I cooked, it was pretty shitty. And I had that sort of fixed in my identity as, like, I just don't cook. And that's how our relationship is. She's really good at that. She enjoys it. I'll, like, clean up everything. I'll buy all the groceries and all that. But I just don't, that's just not really what I bring to the table. That's fine. That's just who I am. And then I noticed over this period in the summer when I was microdosing consistently that I was like, I just started thinking about it differently. I didn't sit down and say, I want to think about cooking differently and how I relate to my wife in this regard differently. I just started naturally shifting and changing. And so then I started messing around with things and trying something here. This is easy. And then I realized, actually, this is a pain in the ass, but slow cooker recipes, wow, that's a total hack for me, and I like this. So I'm going to buy a book on slow cooker recipes. And then I did that. And then, you know, fast forward, like, a couple months later, last night, I made these incredible, like, honey Dijon pork chops in a slow cooker. My wife comes home, and she's like, I cannot believe that you made this shit. I'm like, neither can I.
Me neither, right.
And that's, you know, that's not something that anybody's going to write a book about. Like, I had this epiphany and now I make slow cooker recipes. But they're slight little adjustments in changing your behavior and your way of thinking about things that when you kind of add those up over time, you're doing things significantly differently, you know, and things can change.
My buddy said to me one day, he was at home. This is probably a decade ago. In Philadelphia, one of my dearest friends was living with his girlfriend at the time, and she was away, I guess visiting family or whatever, and he had the day off, and I was working or something, and I was like, you know, what are you going to do? He's like, oh, I'm going to sit around and eat some mushrooms, you know, see what happens. And I talked to him later in the day, and I was like, how'd your day go? He was like, it was great. He goes, I built a shelf. I'm like, okay. He's like, never built a shelf before. He's like, sitting around, I had some books on the desk. I was like, you know what? I'm going to go out. I'm going to figure out how to build a shelf. You know, same deal. I built a shelf.
Yep. Yeah.
Never
these
built one
weird
before.
Little things.
Never made the honey Dijon before.
Right. Yeah. But then it's a difference now I can make a fucking honey Dijon pork chops, and my life is better that I can do that versus only making like peanut butter toast when I'm home and there's somebody else to make something for me or ordering food. Yeah, these like little adjustments, and that's what's so cool. It's just crazy how the science of it is really catching up, because there's a saying out there that like there's three basic like unknowns to human existence right now: space, deep ocean,
right,
and consciousness, right? Those three things we really don't know that much about and are truly truly unexplored, and we're starting like very slowly to kind of break open the black box of the brain and of the mind and understand, all right, now we can see that psychedelics actually make you one of the things they do is they make you more sensitive to your environment,
right?
You know, so your friend saying, you know, he went and built a shelf, he actually could have been sitting around and said, on a kind of subtle level, my life would be, this environment would be better for me if I had a fucking shelf on the wall.
Right.
So I'm gonna go build one, you know?
Right. And
when you start thinking like that, instead of being like, fucking books are annoying, you know, that's like an actual, the compass effect of that, of if you translate that over 5 years and 10 years or 20 years, is a completely different life. And that's what fascinates me about it. I think that's one thing that Lucci and I really, you know, geeked out about.
It can certainly jar you off your path, you know.
Yes.
And you start to examine things like, not just like, what did I say to somebody today, but like, how did I make somebody feel with what I said today, you know?
Yeah.
Just taking that next iteration, that next little deviation of thought, just taking it a little bit further. It's like the space shuttle. If you launch straight up, you're going straight up. If you're off by 1/1000th of a millimeter, by the time you get to outer space, you're 10 billion miles off course. It's like these little, tiny little changes. And every day you make them. I mean, you make them when you're sober, right? Every day 100%. You decide to go take the car out at 2 o'clock and you hit an animal by accident. It's something that sticks with you, and you're going to think about it, and it's going to alter your thought process for the rest of your day, for the rest of your week, for the rest of your life. It'll alter the way that you drive for the rest of your life. If you decide to have a pastry in the morning instead of having a banana, it affects your thought process for the rest of the day, how you feel about yourself, how you feel about your diet, you know, all these things. And you know, psychedelics can just kind of open some bigger doors and push you The image I have in my head, Charlie, is like when you're on a train and you hit certain spots on the track where you know that the track can move side to side so that obviously trains don't wind up colliding into each other. And it's like one of those, man. And then, you know, also like a choose your own adventure book on top of it. You remember those?
Absolutely, dude. Yeah, absolutely. That's a good way to put it. Yeah, it's just really fascinating to see, to experience it. And one of the other things too that you realize, I've had this realization a couple of times when I've taken larger doses, is you step back and you're like, I don't need a substance or a drug
right.
for me to actually know some of these things. I know this shit. It's just showing me what I already know. You know, I know that I shouldn't be smoking, or that I should be drinking less, or that I really need to mend the relationship with my mom. You know, these things that you already know that you've maybe been running from or avoiding, you know, it just kind of reflects back to you where you're at and the nature of your mind. But unlike a lot of other drugs, it's not something you have to keep doing. You don't have to, like, you have that knowledge then. You don't have to, like, you know, continually take a substance in order to recreate that. So,
And people struggle their whole lives trying to get to that point where they can flip the switch. You know, people will sit at home and they'll watch YouTube video after YouTube video of Tony Robbins or some type of motivational speaker or somebody's story about, hey, I was a fat piece of shit and now I'm shredded and I weigh 160 pounds and I run 200 miles a week, you know, and all I do is eat raw food and vegetables and, or, you know, I used to drink every single day and now I've been sober for 6 days and one day I just decided enough was enough. People, they try their whole lives to hit those inflection points to break free from either their habits or how they're thinking or their perception of the world in general. You know, that and there's multi-billion dollar industries that have been created around it. You know, I was listening to one podcast the other day. I think it was one of the Joe Rogan podcasts where the woman was talking about how she quit drinking and how she quit smoking. You know, she read some book called the Right Way to Quit Drinking or The Right Way to Quit Smoking or The Easy Way to Quit Smoking or whatever. And she said, I put the book down and that was it, you know? So whatever was in there fucking jarred something loose in her head and got her to kind of look at things from the outside looking in or look at them from a different perspective. And it's when you make those seismic kind of thinking changes that you can make seismic changes in your life.
Yeah. And they can, like, I mean, I'm reading a book right now about this guy, written by this guy who's one of the pioneers of all of psychedelic medicine and research. His name's Stanislav Grof. And one of the things that he talks about is, like, people can have the types of experiences that are brought about via psychedelics from other things. And one of the things that can do that is a spiritual, like, emergency. People who are, well, let's just say this. If you think about the times in your life when you've changed, I know this is probably true. This is definitely true for me in a lot of ways. It's because the pain of continuing what you're doing actually overcomes, is greater than the resistance to change. And for me, a lot of times, it is required to have a lot of pain and discomfort to finally be like, fuck, I got to change this. I got to do something different. And I think psychedelics are a way to not have to go through that, right? You can kind of expedite that and just bring yourself up to a decision point. It doesn't have to be some challenging trip where you come out and you're like, oh my God, I got to change my whole life. But they can just bring you up faster to this decision point and give you a sense of perspective that helps you change in a way that otherwise it might take, like, serious life circumstances, right, and adversity in order to make you say, I got to do this.
I was thinking about that earlier, and I have a notepad. Some episodes I write down notes beforehand, other ones I don't. I didn't have anything written down today, and I wasn't going to write anything down, but I took out a pad, and I scribbled down a couple of things while we were talking earlier. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you was whether or not you were religious, because I was drawing that comparison there, like you're saying, having a spiritual awakening and, you know, like you're talking now about hitting that low point where the pain is overwhelming. And oftentimes that's where people seek out religion. I was interested in kind of what your thoughts on theology were, if you had any, given your experience, given what I, you know, believe is your unique experience. I would say 999 out of every 1,000 listeners that listen to this podcast probably don't have your experience in terms of psychedelic enlightenment. So where has that brought you on your on your personal path to spirituality or faith?
That's a really good question. I was raised, my grandfather was a Presbyterian minister for a long time. So I was raised going to church. You know, it's not Catholic, it's a different animal, Presbyterian, but I was raised going to church every Sunday, and I was raised Christian. And then I sort of drifted away from that over time, really because I came to the point where I was like, I just can't believe that there's all these people of different faiths. Actually, you know what really did it for me? Not to go too far down a rabbit hole, but it was 9/11. And I was just so shocked. I was a freshman in high school when that happened. And I was so shocked by the situation, in part because I was like, there are people who so believe in what they believe in that they're willing to blow themselves and other people up So just thinking about the degree of that faith and then realizing, I was just thinking about from a Christian perspective, like these people haven't, it just, so they believe that just because they were born in a different place. If they'd been born in the United States, odds are they wouldn't have been exposed to those sorts of ideas.
Or like, you know, sort of perspective. 20 miles to the west.
right. So that really, I was like, okay, I think the fact that I'm Christian is much more a matter of, you know, a numbers game. There's a probability that I ended up, you know, being one of the 20% of the people on the planet who is, rather than whatever. So I kind of drifted away from that, didn't really know. And then I got really into meditation and Buddhism, not as a, I would say, I'd call it more secular Buddhism, right? I think there are aspects of Buddhist faith that are about, you know, recreation and karma. And I don't, honestly don't have like full opinions on those now, but I would say, and I wouldn't call myself religious, but I would say that my experience with psychedelics has definitely exposed me to things and sort of confirmed truths that my other life experiences and studying Buddhist philosophy and my experiences meditating had also confirmed for me. And I've had experiences through meditating a lot over, you know, the last 10 years where I did feel my sense of self completely dissolve and like a, you know, real transcendent experience, where I felt very, connected to everything that was around me, my environment, my surroundings, my sense of self. And with that, any sort of like suffering that is attached to things that my ego, you know, holds on to dissolved and went away. And those are also states that at times I've experienced while taking psychedelics. So I think some of my psychedelic experiences have like corroborated things that I've experienced through sort of secular Buddhist practices and teachings. But I definitely, I don't know if I would, still wouldn't call myself, I wouldn't call myself religious, I wouldn't say.
Yeah, I, you know, I have a very similar path, right? I was raised Episcopal and had a lot of the same questions. Just like you said, and I mentioned them on the podcast before too, which is,
right.
It's fascinating to me that everybody has a God and everybody's God is the best God. And, you know,
right.
That's just insane to begin with, right? And even insane. If there is one God, you know, let's start to line up all of the things that match, because there's a lot of similarities in a lot of the different religious stories, and let's just work on those and let's be one big happy family. You know, you're doing Hanukkah, we're doing Christmas, he's doing Ramadan, whatever. You know, as I said on the podcast, we're all just getting together with family and having some wine and eating, right? We all want the same things. We all want to be with our family. We all want love. We all want security. You know, there's a lot of common ground there, and there's something really ugly about faith that when people get so deeply entrenched into it, I think without being able to kind of discern the nuances, probably the people that need some psychedelics. But
right.
People cling to it as an answer for what they don't understand. And they cling to it as an answer for all of their questions. And I don't have any issue with people of faith. And my journey with religion is ongoing. It changes every day. I think it's something I think about all the time. More recently, I spoke to Lucci about, you know, years back learning how to surrender, and I had read when I was in college Being Peace by Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese monk, right? And that dude's on some shit, right? So I was reading that in
he's on some shit.
Oh man, I was reading that in college and it was making a little bit of sense. And then I picked it back up again when I was, I don't know, 32 or whatever, and all of a sudden started to make a little bit more sense. Then I started to kind of understand a little bit more about meditation, you know, and what really is meditation? What's the point of meditation? You know, how do you breathe? What's the point of breathing one way versus breathing another way? What happens physiologically to your body, to your mind when you meditate? You know, because normally every time I try to meditate in my 20s, would sit down for, you know, 16 seconds and be breathing like hyperventilating, you know, just got in probably from stone skateboarding.
Right.
And I would sit there and I go, and I'd be like, this fucking meditation stuff's not working. And now I'm pissed off, you know, I feel worse than when I started.
Yeah,
and it's sure. Not until you kind of realize exactly. Actually, for me, the big profound discovery that I got from, you know, going to cognitive behavioral therapy and learning these things, the biggest profound discovery I had was that, you know, calm should be your default state, and your fight or flight mechanism and panic is not the default. And when I kind of learned that, that was the first kind of thing that helped. You know, one of a million steps that helped me kind of turn the Titanic a little bit off course from the course that it was on. And then you learn about meditation as a way to kind of tap into that calm, right? It's like, all right, well, what happens when I get really fucking calm, right? Like, the difference between right. sitting there and breathing deep, but like, how about breathing really deep and focusing on whatever, one thing and just that's it. And then what happens? And then from there, you know, meditation is something people do their whole lives, and they, you know, some people it's a challenge their whole lives. Some people they never get it. Some people they get it right away, but they want to go deeper when they do it. It's one of those things that you do it and you just kind of learn as you go. All of these weird questions and things that you like, if you're discovering it on your own and all you hear is focus on your breath, right? Because that's what Thich Nhat Hanh would say, right? He would say focus on your in breath and all the other questions, like, well, what am I supposed to think about? What happens when something else pops into my head? What happens when this happens? You know, is it always going to feel one way? Is it always going to feel another way? You discover those answers as you go along, and
right.
It's only, I think Dan Harris made the analogy that it's like walking around with a closed fist, you know, and the more you yell at the fist to open, the less likely it is to open. And once you just surrender to having a closed fist, then it starts to open. And so I went the Buddhist route also for a while. And I still, like you said, I've had some really great moments where over the last half decade I've coped with things in a very different way than I used to. I would either just put it away and not think about it or whatever, and oftentimes now I find myself trying to embrace how I feel when I feel a way that's not, you know, quote unquote traditionally favorable. When I feel upset or when I feel like I've been wronged or I feel like I've done something wrong, or, you know, I feel ashamed or I feel guilty, or, you know, I deal with that very differently now. I don't bask in it, but I allow it to be. And one of the coolest things I read in one of Thich Nhat Hanh books was, you know, emotions are like a stream. There's always one coming after the one that you have now. Right. You just kind of have to wait for it to get there. So now it's okay to feel the way that you feel. And I don't know. Yeah, I've kind of gone the same route. And it's just of recent, the last year, you know, I've been looking at the angle of religion and spirituality a little bit differently, with that understanding of wanting to get to a calm place. And I haven't made any profound changes, but I certainly feel like I'm looking at it from a different perspective than I was a decade ago. And I feel like at least I'm growing, even if slowly, right?
Yeah, it's really, my experience is very similar. It's really subtle in a lot of ways.
Right.
And like when you talk about faith, I think about it as much now as like a practice, as a daily exercise, of thinking about what are the things that improve my life and make me feel better. And a lot of them are, you know, principles that I guess you could call are Buddhist principles, like, you know, the concept of attachment. Right. Do I determine the way I feel? Is the way I feel determined by how things that are outside of my control unfold? Like, is my identity attached to certain things that are really based about my ego? Is it really important for me? Can I only be happy if I think that other people think that I'm successful?
Right.
You know, is that, and just some of them are, it's just like really, I think there's a ton of overlap. I know there is between cognitive behavioral therapy and Buddhist philosophy. I mean, tons. There's a lot of Buddhism. It's just really good therapy. It's good stuff to think about. And yeah, so I've felt that feed into my life in a big way for sure. And I've also, I mean, growing up, the concept of hell, like, I had a really vivid imagination growing up. And so the concept of hell was like paralyzingly terrifying to me, that you could be condemned to like fire and brimstone forever, that there's no end to that, right? And that was actually a risk. And I kind of walked around thinking, this is insane. If this is possible, that everybody isn't just doing everything at all times to avoid this outcome, right? Because my God, think about it. Like, who cares if you like get this cheeseburger in the drive-through window? You could be going to hell, dude. So like, the only thing you should be doing is praying and asking for forgiveness and stuff like that. And obviously, as I grew and like my opinions on that, my concept of hell or whether it even existed, like, totally changed. But I did, I think something stuck with me, which was this idea of like thinking about worst case scenario. If X happens, what could I handle that? Okay. And if something worse happens, could I handle that? If something worse happens, and if you kind of start to get anxious, one of the things that you can do is ask yourself, well, what's the worst case scenario? Well,
that's a legit coping mechanism that you get. I mean, I was taught that in therapy.
Oh, that it's just like therapy 101, right? You realize you're catastrophizing and making a bigger deal out of it than you need to. And you say, okay, what's the worst case scenario? If I can handle that, okay, then I don't need to be anxious. And in my thought process, when I kind of go down that ladder, I often get to the point, the question is, well, I could die. Okay, I could die. That would be the worst case scenario.
Like, you don't have to worry about anything.
Yeah, and then my answer, and if I can have an answer to that that isn't scary, then I'm like, well, then what the fuck do I have to worry about?
Right.
And I had a psychedelic experience where it's not like I, in the moment, I wasn't like, okay, I'm dying and I'm experiencing death. But coming out of it, I was just like, okay, I understand what it's like to die now. And I'm not really afraid of that. And that was a huge, like, kind of watershed moment for me in a strangely subtle way. I hope it sticks with me. I'm not going to say I know what happens, you know, after we die, but at least right now I have some sort of mental construct that death is not something to be afraid of. And that, that is, like, I think at the convergence of my experiences with psychedelics and, you know, my concept of faith, if you could call it that, in a really freeing way, I think.
Well, a lot of my anxieties were tied to health. Also were tied to my physical health years back. And I would worry about my physical health and I would obsess over it and, you know, develop hypochondria over it. And then all of a sudden, physically, your health takes a turn for the worse because your mental state is atrocious. And for me, getting...
Yeah, it feeds on itself.
Oh, yeah. Oh, in a way that I never thought possible, in a way that is just insane. If you don't understand the mind-body connection and how physical symptoms can arise from your mind not being in the right place, I mean, that's a great place to start. If you haven't looked into that, it's worth educating yourself on. But like you, and it's interesting, man, I mean, we have very similar stories, man. Like you, had a moment or several moments where I stopped kind of fearing death. And, you know, it's not that I want to die, because I don't.
Yeah.
you know, right. But I'm not terrified of it. I'm just, Penn Jillette said something great on a podcast like years back, and they asked him like, Penn, are you worried about, you know, what's going to happen in the year 2100? And he was like, no. And they said, well, why not? You know, he said, for the same reason I'm not worried about the year 1776. You know, it doesn't have anything to do with me. You know, it's I'll be long gone, right? And right. I don't know. It was that and a couple other things. I had some moments where I just, you know, you accept that everybody's going to die. We're all going to die, right? Yeah, there's the unknown of the afterlife. I think it's far more likely that, I mean, I don't even want to postulate, but I think it's that unknown that kind of throws people for a loop. And just to go back to your point of what's the worst that could happen and attachment, you know, one of the other realizations I had some years back was what can people take from me? You know, what can you take? What do I have that somebody could take from me? What am I attached to? You know, what do I allow to be my weakest, you know, points, my points of leverage or whatever? And, you know, a lot of times people think about their family. A lot of times people think about money. You know, money's a huge one. And I would encourage people to go into a room and like listen to one of their favorite songs and then realize no matter how much money you have at the end of the day, that song is always going to sound like that song. And if you love it, like you're going to love it, whether you got $10 million in the bank or you have zero in the bank, you know, and that was just one of these stupid little realizations I had along the line. Well, if I woke up tomorrow and I lost my life savings and lost my house, well, I could still listen to 311, you know, I like that band, you know, I
could 311, yes.
Figure out a way to put them on, right? I could still talk to people. I could still breathe. I could still, you know, you take it down to the basics, man. I remember years back walking through Rittenhouse Square Park and just seeing a young woman who was in a wheelchair, who I think was a quadriplegic, you know, and I had just walked past her and I just made a note in my, I carry like a little notebook with me sometimes, you know, just reminding myself to remember that, you know, right. If you lose the money or you lose the family member or you lose, you know, you're always going to have, you'll always have something, you know, and there's always a part of you that people are not going to be able to take away until you're dead. And then I think you don't have to worry about it then, you know?
Right.
You can keep your dignity. You can keep your integrity. You can keep your respect for yourself. You can keep what does Graham Hancock say? He says your sovereignty over your own mind, right?
Yeah. And you realize that is, I mean, listen, I'm 32. I'm not going to say I have everything figured out, but I've realized that is the most important thing for me. And it is one of the things that is in my control. And you realize how quickly people relinquish their control over that. I mean, that's one thing that actually we haven't talked about this yet, but so I lived, last time we talked, I was in Hanoi in Vietnam, right? And because my wife and I lived in Asia for 9 months, and one of the places that we lived was in Chiang Mai, Thailand. And I had this crazy experience there where there's this donut shop in Chiang Mai and people line up. It's like the only donut shop really in all of Chiang Mai. This is a town of like 250,000 people in the north of Thailand. And people line up for hours outside of this donut shop, 2 hours ahead of time. It opens up at noon and they make a certain amount of donuts each day. And then once they sell out, that's it. They're done.
Yeah,
right?
that was on Anthony Bourdain, wasn't it?
Was it? I don't know.
Unknown? I think it was. All right, keep going. Yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, no worries. So naturally, I'm sitting here thinking, why do they stop? Why don't they just make more donuts and like scale up and open up a new location and, you know, franchise it and go global? Like, why wouldn't you just do more of that? And I was talking to one of our friends there who was Thai, and I asked her that question, and she just looked back at me. She was like, well, why would they do that? And I was like, well, you know, they could make more money. They're running a business. They could make more money. And she, it was so not an inherent part of her paradigm, of her way of thinking. And she was just like, well, that's not the point. That's not why they are doing it. The business gives them what they need in order to pay their bills or whatever. But really the thing for them is the time with their family and their faith, their Buddhist faith, and, you know, their friends, and how they spend their time outside of making these donuts. That's not what they're optimizing for. That's not the game that they're playing.
Right.
And it was really, you obviously we all hear cliches of like money isn't everything and stuff like that. But I think it was removing myself from the cultural context of America and seeing people and being like, oh shit, for some people, money really isn't constantly factored into their thinking on a conscious and a subconscious level. Like, it is not the primary driver of their decision making. And it caused me to step back and question, okay, like, what, you know, things about your identity and what you, you know, build yourself around, and these things that we think are fundamental truths of, well, my professional success, like, is part of my identity, or is my identity. And you realize as you go to other places, like, well, it's just not true. They have completely different ways of thinking about the self. And so in the kind of the same way that we talked about religion, you're born in the States, more likely to be Christian. You're born in certain Middle Eastern countries, and more likely to be Muslim. Like, that's kind of a matter of, these things that we feel like are a huge part of identities are a little bit of a matter of chance, right? Some of the a lot of the values that we have and these things that we stake our identities around in non-religious contexts are, in my experience, like, just as much about random chance and what culture you're born into. And I think we live in a really fucking cool time where now we have a much wider perspective, and we get to sort of sample all these different types of thinking and places, and we get to choose for ourselves, right? Because if you were born at any point up until whatever, 1900, like, you were pretty much dealing with whatever was within a 20-mile radius of where you were born.
Right.
That was your perspective. Yeah, so that like widening of scope, you know, I don't know how fully that relates to...
Well, it's huge. I mean, it's important whether you get it from traveling, you know, which certainly can help you expand those horizons, or you get it from meditating, or you get it from hallucinogens. I mean, it's only once you break out of the confines of what you think is normal, what you think the day-to-day is supposed to look like, that you can really become some type of rock that other people break themselves on, you know, as opposed to the other way around, right? Kind of letting yourself be dictated to and having people tell you, hey, do this, hey, do that, you know? Because if I woke up and I had lost everything that I owned tomorrow and I had to start from zero, nada, I had nothing, right? Just the clothes on my back. I know I could do it. And I know, yeah, I could do it with a good attitude. And I know I would still take pleasure in a lot of the things that I take pleasure doing today. Like, you know, going to the park and looking at the ducks, you know, stupid shit, right? Like, right, just talking to people, having a conversation with somebody, you know, like this podcast, I'm enjoying immensely.
Right.
Right. Right. There's certain things that, you know, like you said, they're more important than money. It's difficult to understand in, I think, where we were born. I think it's difficult to understand in the United States. I think it's difficult to understand in a lot of first world countries across the globe. And I think when you have that realization, or better yet, you know, personally, if you're able to broaden your horizons, not only do you become the rock that other people break themselves on, you garner this, I don't even want to call it power, but you garner this immense enlightenment. And I don't know, certainly what I've noticed is that in our society, the points with which I draw the most interest from other people are times when I would shun, you know, what, and I'll give you a perfect for instance. Okay. I've been getting, you know, investment opportunities left and right for the podcast. Okay. Right. I've had, and I don't know if I've talked about this or not, but regardless, I've had people come up to me, hey, try to throw money at me. We want you to do this. We want you to do that. We want you to come on our, you know, network. We want you to, you know, merge the podcast into this website, into that website, whatever. And I'm just like, no, I'm really happy. You know, I'm actually like, I'm enjoying myself. I make a little bit of money from the people that are kind enough to donate to me. And all of my analytics and all those things are all moving in the right direction. You know, people are showing an interest in what I talk about. This is, it's like it says in my Patreon, you know, you don't have to be number one. You just have to be something for somebody. And the responses that that elicits from people that have tried to invest are very interesting. They come back.
Bafflement.
Bafflement. Combativeness is another one. You know, well, you just think you're going to be able to do this forever. I mean, you're not going to be getting opportunities like this all the time. You know,
right.
Like, all right, well then,
it's threatening, man. If I don't, I don't.
You know, if I don't,
That's something you realize as you start to change your behavior too. And this is one of the things that's really tough in any kind of behavioral change is it's threatening to people. You know,
I mean, somebody could turn around tomorrow and offer me $1 million for the podcast, and I would say no.
Yeah, and so the person who offered you that is like, "What the fuck are you talking about?" No,
right.
My whole construct is built on wanting $1 million.
Right.
So if you're telling me no, you're not just turning me down. You're causing me to question a lot of things that I don't really want to question.
Right, and they know I don't have shit. You know, so they're like, well, this should do it, you know. And I'm not saying that I won't do something down the line. But I'm so content right now. Why would I fuck with it?
Right.
You know, and it's the same about
you. Kind of found your donut, the equivalent of your donut shop. Basically.
Exactly, brother. That's all we're doing is making fucking donuts here. Me and you. We're gonna make 500. Okay. And if you're in line early enough, you're gonna get one. And if you're not, you gotta fucking come back tomorrow. It's that simple. And if I want to take 15 days off and go to Vegas and have a bender, then that's what I'm going to do. And if I want to have Richard Gage from Architects and Engineers from 9/11 Truth on, that's what I'm going to do. That's another thing, too. Well, you know, certainly I wouldn't interfere with what you're doing, but I'm just saying I wouldn't have had Richard Gage on. Well, that sounds like interfering to me.
It sounds like fucking interference to me.
Yeah. You know, the recipe I got for the donut right now is pretty good. I'm going to crank these fuckers out. Right. And we'll all sit together, Charlie, and we will all eat our donuts together.
I like that future.
One of the things you talked about before that I really liked was, you know, how, just to go back to psychedelics for a second, was like how they prepare you. You know, that the further you broaden your horizons, you know if everybody's at zero and the normal range of everyday emotions is from, you know, 0 to 25 and back from 0 back to -25. And you can take psychedelics and they push you to +35 and -35. And you come back from that. All you got to realize is, oh, I'm just keeping it right now between the 25s now when I'm done. Like, this is, I've been further than this. And I've been more depressed than this or whatever. I've been more panicked than this. And that's one of the things I love about jiu-jitsu. And one of the things that...
Like, yes, we need to talk about jiu-jitsu, man.
We will, yeah. One of the things that hooked me about it is... Every time you train, and for people that don't know about jiu-jitsu, essentially most places when you go and you take a jiu-jitsu class, what I'm discovering here through my global jiu-jitsu travels, is you go in, you know, you get a warm-up in and you drill and you learn technique for about an hour, and then there's usually about an hour of live fighting, like live sparring. And the object generally in jiu-jitsu when you're sparring is to get somebody in a position where you can, you know, manipulate one of their limbs in the wrong direction. or choke them unconscious, at which point, you know, one of those two things happens, the person taps out, and then you start over, and you just go, and you roll one match. They say rolling in jiu-jitsu. You roll one match, then you roll another, then you roll another, then you roll another. And when you're going live and you're sparring, you know, you're getting after it. The other person is trying to choke you, or they're trying to, you know, get you in a position where they can break your arm or something.
Yeah, they're trying to submit you. Yeah.
Right. And you're trying to do the same thing. So it's a very, what it does is it puts your mind in this very basic, very raw kind of survive mode. And the nice thing is, you know, you're taking it right up to the limit. You're taking it right up to, you know, 3 more seconds and I would be unconscious, or, you know, one half an inch more of cranking my hips up and the arm would break or something. You're taking it right there, and then you're coming back and you're just starting over again. And one of the things I love about it is every day when I step out of training, the feeling that I have when I walk out the front door and I'm just breathing fresh air after, you know, coming, not really, but theoretically, you know, within an inch of going unconscious, or within an inch of having an arm broken or whatever. And also putting other people in that position, it does the same thing. It's just, it's preparing. It broadens your mental, you know. I'll give you a perfect example. A couple months ago, somebody was flipping out in a Wawa around here. You know, maybe a few years ago before I had started training jiu-jitsu, I would have, who knows, I would have done something, maybe I would have left, whatever. You know, now I just kind of stood there. And I was like, all right, like, let's see what happens here, you know, like, right. This guy's not close to me now, but maybe he will be, maybe he won't. It just, like I said, he's operating within negative 25 to plus 25. I'm operating negative 35 to plus 35. So I'm just going to sit and watch and see how he ping pongs in between the 25s, right?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, jiu-jitsu, so I was training, now just talking about it with you, man. Since moving back here, I haven't gotten back into it. I've been too busy, which is a bullshit excuse. I just need to do it.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, it's horseshit. I kind of told myself I wasn't going to pick it up until all grad school applications were in, which is like holding a carrot out in front of me, because I really crave getting back into it.
Dude,
I did it.
Jiu-jitsu is grad school.
Dude, well said. You're absolutely right. Unfortunately, they won't let me say that when I sit for the licensing exam. But I agree with you generally that that it just teaches you. I mean, you want to talk about ego death?
Oh my God!
I went into jiu-jitsu. I was a good athlete growing up, and I'm a decent sized guy. I'm like 6'3", 200 pounds. And I went into jiu-jitsu to one of the first, I'd gone like a couple times. So I knew enough about like general technique and whatnot. I think I'd been going for like a month that they let me into the rolling section, right? Like one of the classes where you can actually roll, because before, when you don't know shit, you can actually really hurt somebody. This is a really incredible experience. And the guy who ran the studio, who was a multiple black belt in New York, in Brooklyn, he was like, "Charlie, come here, you know, let's roll together." I was like, "Oh my God."
What's his name?
I'm completely blanking on his name, which is tragic. The school is called Brooklyn Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and it's in Cobble Hill. It's a great place. And so he brought me in. And he's like, "Okay, let's roll." So you get down on your knees and you kind of bow to one another, and then he's like, "All right, you know, just kind of come at me and let's do this." And he looks like, in any normal walk in life, like an accountant. He looks very harmless. He's way smaller than me. Like, I had always thought going into it, like, okay, all this technique shit is great, but if I really need to, I can muscle my way out of the situation.
Right.
Right. Like, if it gets to the point where I need to move this guy, I can do that. And basically it felt, the experience of rolling with him felt like an anaconda, like wrapping itself around me. And he was super in control the entire time. And like as calm, I don't even think his breath like changed. And he just, every single thing I did, he had this perfect reaction to me. And every single time he kind of pulled me in a little bit tighter, and he pulled his arm around here. Okay, now my left arm is pinned. And then he pulled a different way, whatever. Now he was sitting on my chest And I was like, okay, well, I can move my legs. Then pin my legs. And he got to the point where he completely, not only did he have me pinned, where I literally couldn't move, he was blocking out with his body all of like the light, so I couldn't see anything. And he basically just held me in that position for, I'd say, 10 seconds. And I was pushing as hard as I could to try and get him off of me, and there was nothing I could do. And it was actually a lot of my other experiences in other walks of life that I think helped me at that point, about 5 seconds into that, be like, oh, I get what's happening right now. He's teaching me something. And this is not about, you know, I gotta let go of my ego's, you know, attachment to being able to like kick this guy's ass, because I can't. It is very clear there is nothing I can do about this situation. And then he kind of like let me up, and it was totally this. And then he was like, you know, all right, go to the next person. And it was like this baptism into the experience, I think, of jiu-jitsu, which is just constantly kind of getting broken down like that. And then as time goes on, yeah, the first time you pin somebody else is an incredible feeling. And you're like, ooh, you see what I just did? Holy shit. I can do this. I know how to, you know, I know some shit at this point. But that feeling of constantly, but you don't,
right.
You really, really don't. You don't know shit. And it's very humbling, and it is like it's a grindstone, man, that you just like can constantly sharpen yourself against. and it's nothing. You realize like you will never get there. You'll never get there. Because I looked at him, who was a teacher, and I said, this guy knows all the answers. And then his teacher came one day and taught us some stuff. And I was just like, oh my God, this stuff gets so, so deep and so advanced. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, I had a similar experience my first time rolling. And I was just, it was one of the professors, this gentleman, Professor Isaac, who I love at my school, is a great guy, fantastic teacher. You know, we were getting ready to go for the first time, and I said, I don't even know what to do. I said, well, what am I supposed to do?
You know? Yeah, that's and what he, you confront he said, a lot of it.
He said to me,
I don't know what to do.
He just said to me, and he said it just like this. He's like, and he's like, I think physically I'm bigger than him. I'm like 6'2", 200. I think he's probably like 5'10", 5'11", like maybe 170, but he's in great shape. And he just looked at me and he was like, I want you to try and kill me. And I was like, what the fuck is this guy talking about? He's like, right. I want you to try and kill me. So I'm like, oh, all right. You know, like knowing at that point I'm already fucked, right? I don't even have to move. Like this isn't going to work, whatever I'm bringing here to the table. And, and you know, it was a very controlled and very methodical ass whooping by him.
Yeah.
Similar to that.
You always know, control.
It's
always control.
They'll get you to a point where they're in like full mount and they're just laying on your face and they've grapevined your legs. And
humiliation, man.
Yeah, you know,
I've had grown men put their ass, their sweaty ass, you know, obviously through a gi, but on my face.
Oh, well, that's sad, man.
And if you can wake up, if you can get up from that and go out like into your workday or in the rest of your life and like learn from that, yeah, it takes time to get
it's
there.
It's not even that. I mean, you get over this sweat. I mean, I remember that too, going in the first day, like, what are you going to do? I'm going to roll around with this guy that's sweating, you know? Like,
right.
All right, you know, got over that very quickly. But it's the feeling of, you know, like I said, if somebody has you, whatever, somebody's mounted you and they're laying on top of you and, you know, you can't see anything and you can barely breathe because you're squished between them and the mat. And, you know, it's working out of those situations or, you know, somebody's got an armbar almost on or they've got, you know, 75% of a choke on or they've got your back and, you know, you have to work out of these disadvantageous positions. It's those things that I just love the most about it because, you know, that mentally, it really it changes you significantly. I mean, I remember being, you know, the first couple of times you go in when somebody's just laying on top of you and you can't move. It's mentally, it's an awful feeling. Physically, it's an awful feeling. You know, it feels like alchemy, too, the way that they do it at first. You don't even know that it's possible to be dominated in such a crazy way.
Yeah, totally.
But then, you know, you start to kind of expand how much you can take. And you know, it's a very, very long, lifelong learning track, like you're saying. But it's one that when I leave there, you know, I'm not worried about what's in my email inbox, right? I'm like, holy shit, I can breathe. This is awesome. You know, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to roll the windows down on the way home and listen to fucking nothing at all, you know?
Right. The guy, the professor is Professor Josh Skyer, by the way.
Okay.
And it's Brooklyn Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. The man, shout out to that. I think that you also get a deep appreciation for, like, jiu-jitsu is incredibly complex. There's so much to it. And when I first walked in, I saw people doing it, you know, brown belts or even like deep purple belts. And I was like, there's just no way I'm going to get to this point. Like, I can't. This is insane. When they were first teaching me the basic techniques, and it took me, you know, many classes to learn, you know, the simplest, you know, guard pass, I was like, I'm never going to get there. But then a year later, you kind of look back, you just put your head down. You learn, I guess what I'm trying to say is you learn the value of just showing up every single day.
Yes.
And you learn the value of just, I know I'm going to go in today and I'm probably going to suck. I'm going to forget like half of what I've been taught.
Yep.
And I'm going to get my ass beat and probably humiliate a little bit, and my ego is going to get, you know, take a beating, but I'm just going to keep showing up. And then you do that for a year and you haven't arrived by any means. It's not like you've reached some finish line, but you know a lot more shit than you used to, and you're a lot further along than you were when you started.
You look at it a different way, and, you know,
yeah.
I don't claim to know anything about jiu-jitsu, but what I can tell you is the way that I look at it now, and the way that I just cognitively think about it now, as I'm doing it and as I'm laying in bed at the end of the night thinking about it, are very different. You know, I was a runner for a while, and I still do like to run, and there's some similarities there in the sense that, like, some days I feel super amped up, like I'm ready to go run fucking 5 miles at 7:30s, and I get out there and I feel awful. And other days,
right,
you know, I'm hungover or something on 2 hours sleep, and I'm like, well, I'm gonna run just to get my obligatory run in today. And I put in the best performance of my life. And, you know, the really cool thing is that jiu-jitsu is always going to humble you no matter how far along you get, how great you think you are. There's always somebody bigger than you. There's always somebody better than you. I went to a school in Las Vegas last week when I was there to train at this place called Alliance. They were incredible people, very hospitable. It was lovely that they had me. And you know, just was rolling with those guys there, and there was a kid there that was a purple belt who I, you know, later found out was an IBJJF gold medalist.
Jesus.
And, you know, world class. And he was physically much smaller than me. He was, I don't know, maybe 5'6", 5'7", and maybe 140, I would guess. I don't even know. And he's 17 years old. And I, like I said, I'm 6'2", 200. You know, he was a purple belt. I'm a blue belt. I'm thinking, you know, all right, you know, every once in a while I can hang with a purple belt to the point where I'm not getting just destroyed, you know, like I wind up getting my ass whooped. But, like, you know, I can at least perform some basic functions. And this was just a full out. I mean, in a 6 minute round, I think this kid tapped me like 11 times or something, which is, it's insane. And he wasn't an armbar specialist. It was like fucking armbar. Then it was a Ezekiel choke. Then he was mounting me. Then he was triangling me for mount. Then it was fucking go-go platas. Then he was on my back. Then he was, I was thinking, fuck me. Can I get somewhere where I just sit? Can I just get somewhere where, like, I can just sit for like 10 seconds? You know, can I just sit in closed guard for 10 seconds and just avoid being tapped for 10? And it just wasn't happening. It didn't matter what position I was in.
It's just a jackhammer.
It didn't matter where I moved. It was just an absolute, and it was an extremely humbling experience. One of many that I've had. And just another quick example, like several weeks ago, I had a shitty night at my gym. You know, shitty, it was a great night in the sense that it taught me a lot, but shitty, like I felt bad after I got out, which, you know, admittedly happens to everybody. And I called up a friend of mine who I hadn't talked to in years, who I know is a brown belt. And, you know, we said once in a while, hey, we should train with each other, whatever, you know, get together. But we don't really talk too much anymore. We worked together like 15 years ago. And I just texted him randomly. This was a Friday night, like a month ago. And I was like, yo, dude, you mind if I call you real quick out of nowhere? And he was like, yeah, go ahead. So I called him up and I was like, hey, man, listen, I'm sorry to bother you on a Friday night. But, you know, I just wanted to ask you about like mentally, like what you do when you don't have a great night training, because I have a lot of, I have a lot of difficulty with it. And it's something that I need to learn how to process and learn how to deal with. And you know, again, maybe part of it comes back to ego. Part of it comes back to expectations that you set for yourself. And we had this exceptionally long conversation that went, you know, probably like an hour. I only wanted to talk to him for 5 minutes, but he's telling me also too about, you know, how he got his brown belt and then, you know, he wasn't training as much. And then, you know, he went to a new academy and of course you walk in with a brown belt. So everybody's expecting you to be able to tap everybody else. And, you know, the days where, you know, he found himself tapping black belts and other days where he was getting tapped by purple belts and felt like he couldn't do anything. And at the end of the conversation, he said to me, he's like, dude, he's like, you know, I needed that conversation today too. Like, and it was just like, shit, like here's a guy that's 6 or 7 years ahead of me in his training, or maybe even more than that. And he's feeling the same fucking way that I'm feeling. And what I'm starting to learn is that just never stops for as long as you train. But in the context of then taking those feelings into your everyday life and, you know, making your English muffin in the morning or going to fill up your car with gas, it's really a valuable, valuable way to gain some perspective, I think.
It gives you incredible perspective. And one of the things that in the spirit of sort of connecting it to other parts, other experiences in your life, like off the mat, it acclimates you to things that you otherwise would have thought would kill you or basically be intolerable.
Sure.
So like if I had been a younger version of myself, would have said, there's no way I'm going to stand in a room with somebody who's younger than me, man or woman, who's smaller than me, and who can just plain out kick my ass.
Right.
Like there's no way I'm going to put myself in that room over and over. And it would be mortifying for me. It would be basically intolerable for me to have someone who is like 55 and, you know, nowhere near physically as capable as I am, submit me to the point that I have to ask him to stop doing what he's doing.
Right.
Like there's no way that I would do that. And it just sort of exposes you. You have those things happen to you and you realize, shit, these things that I think are going to kill me or these things that would be intolerable are not. It's fine. And it kind of gets us back to that conversation we're having about, okay, what's your worst case scenario?
Right.
When you actually get exposure to these things and you realize, you know, if I'm an entrepreneur and my business fails, you know, or I'm a trader and I blow up my account, like these things that you think are going to kill you, they happen to you and they don't kill you. And then you just have a moment where you sit back and you're like, oh shit. Okay. All right. Like this, I don't have to run from this anymore. I don't have to use this as the thing that is steering the direction of everything I do. I don't have to avoid this. I obviously don't want to like seek it out, but I know that, you know, it's not going to kill me if I brush up against it. And I think jiu-jitsu does that on a smaller scale and on a frequent basis. And it just like really, it's good. It's good to just be humbled consistently and get your ass kicked, but then also feel like you're growing, like you're accruing. It feels really good. I think it's important for people to have the experience of like accruing, building a skill set. And
it's a much longer change, a much longer term return on your reward too. It's not like you're going to go to your first class and feel great. Chances are you're going to go to your first class and feel like shit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think most people go for the first month and they're like, I haven't, they're like, I'm out. I'm just not gonna. I
I
think
don't get it, right?
I'd be interested to see like what the drop off rates are for most people who sign up. But yeah, it's a much longer time horizon for what you're doing. And I think that's really healthy too, to experience that and to realize like, okay, all right, some of the best things I can do for myself are things that are not going to be comfortable in the moment. That are going to take work, that are going to suck at times, but look where I'm at now. Now that I've done these things, you know, I'm better off for it. So yeah, I think it's incredibly powerful.
I think
It's
probably
also,
as you continue your the rewards that you know, not the rewards, but the what it returns to you personally probably changes as well. I mean,
yeah.
from, you know, hey, I finally submitted somebody, or hey, I didn't submit somebody, or I didn't allow myself to get submitted, or hey, I submitted a higher belt, to oh, I rolled an extra long round, to then eventually, you know, who knows what that'll feel like 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Will I get that buzz from helping somebody? Will I get that buzz from teaching somebody? You know, what will I be striving for personally? Like, what, but the return, what it returns to you is immense. It's an immense feeling. And it's, you know, there's some competitiveness to it. So there, you know, especially when you compete. So obviously, you know, it feels good
Oh
to
yeah,
win.
how's that?
But
How's that?
it also feels
How's
good.
that?
It also feels good to lose too. Like
Yeah.
I've had my friend Jake put me in a knee bar like 3 months ago, when he had mounted me, and I don't know exactly what he did, but he did some fancy shit where he spun around and he put me in a knee bar. And the way that he did it was just so beautiful that like immediately after I tapped, I was just like, yeah. You know, and I just
No,
fucking like I high-fived
that
him, and I was like,
moment.
dude, that was fucking awesome. Like, you know,
And
like,
that is a moment that is only possible for you because it is lack of ego, right? I mean, if you were attached to your ego, you'd be like, fuck, this guy
oh
just fucking
yeah.
got me. And that, look at what must people think about me and blah, blah, blah. But that moment where you can just like celebrate somebody else doing something so well.
Oh, dude, and I get that all the time. I get all the
Yes.
time I feel like that. Not only just 'cause I like this dude, Jake, and I like everybody I train with. There isn't anybody at the gym that I dislike. They're all great people, but like I get excited when other people hit things on me. I mean, I had a white belt you know, just pass my guard yesterday. And like right at the end of a match, just, you know, it was like a beautiful stack pass from, you know, as far as what I know what a stack pass is supposed to be. But it was, and I was just like, dude, I was like, that was fucking awesome, man. I was like, you know,
Right.
great round. Like,
Yeah.
it gives me a buzz too, you know, because like, I don't know, it's cool to kind of see other people getting it also too. There's just something about jiu-jitsu in general though that I like. I like the movements, I like the cognitive part of it, I like the art. Who
I mean, it's like
knows?
mental chess. It totally
Well,
occupies
that's
your
what
mind.
everybody says. Yeah, that's what
Yeah.
everybody says, right? It
And
does.
there's no way to be, I mean, just like, there's just no way. It's too demanding to be caught up in your own shit at any given point. Like you're just pushed to that point that you have to be engaged, mentally engaged in what you're doing. You can't be thinking about work or any of the other shit. It really forcefully removes
And
you.
sometimes you can't. Sometimes you can overthink it. You know, as I'm Look, for the limited amount that I know about it, one of the things I'm starting to learn now is disengaging mentally a little bit, allowing myself to go with momentum instead of, you know, fighting
Oh, that's the
momentum to,
hardest thing.
you know,
That
and
was the
just.
hardest thing for me. Yeah, for sure. Was I was constantly saying like, okay, especially when I was training with higher belts, I was like, okay, well, he does this. Like, what am I supposed to do here? There's like four things. I think there's four things I can do here. I can do this, and if I do that, then he does this. If I do this, and he does this. And they would see me doing it, and they'd be like, yo, chill, man.
You're
Like,
so
come.
fucked already, man, when you
Yeah,
say that, you know?
A, if they wanted to, they would have just owned me with that.
Right.
But B, they were like, and you realize, all right, I can just kind of focus on my breath, and shut my mind off.
Right.
And I mean, not to get like too meta with this or just whatever, infuse everything with psychedelics, but I will say, microdosing and doing jiu-jitsu was a pretty eye-opening experience for me because that sense of self, I feel like, was a little bit more dissolved. And I was able to kind of be present with it. There were times when I really shut off and just sort of like, you know, when you really just kind of let go and you sink in and you kind of shut your brain off, your body is moving and you're just kind of trusting that it knows what to do.
Yeah.
And like letting go like that. I felt like I was able to tap into that wavelength a little more readily. And then I realized like, I don't need a fucking substance to do that. I can do that on my own. But like kind of gave me a glimpse of it so that I could step into that more easily. It was interesting.
One of the best, you know, rolling sessions I've ever had. One of the best sparring sessions I ever had was at this place, 609 Jiu-Jitsu in South Jersey. When I'm in New Jersey, I'll stop in there. The guys are super great guys. It's a great gym. But it was a Saturday or Sunday open mat, and the guys had just turned the fucking music way up, and it was like 15 songs in a row that I liked. And I was just sitting there going from one guy to the next, rolling 1 5-6-7 minute round after the next, whatever they were. And I was just bobbing my head and I was just listening to the music and I was plugged into what was on the music. And I was doing, you know, I felt like my jiu-jitsu was better than average that day. And I was happy with how I was performing. I wasn't really thinking about it. I was thinking about singing along to whatever was on and just right, allowing myself right. to just work, you know, trusting my body that it was going to work in the right way, which is crazy for somebody that hasn't been training that long, you know?
Yeah.
You start to tap into those first couple of like doing that. And it's a pretty cool feeling. It's a feeling I'm going to chase forever.
Yeah,
that's for
I
sure.
mean, it's like, a, yeah, it's a feeling worth chasing. That's for sure. It doesn't come easily.
So, all right. Well, listen, Mr. Backgate, it's been two fantastic hours, and I still have a list of questions here for you, but I'm going to save
Hit
these
me.
For next time.
No word.
Yeah, I'm going to save these for the next one, and I want to have you back on, though. Will you come back on, like, probably in 4 weeks exactly?
Sure, man.
Come back on in mid-November?
I would love to. Very much enjoyed this conversation. It
yeah,
was awesome.
Dude, absolutely. And and for people that want to check out what you're doing, where can they do that?
Yeah, I mean, just go to sanglucci.com, wallstreetjesus.com. I mean, I'm pretty behind the scenes with a lot of that. I'm on Twitter, I guess, but I don't really
What's
tweet,
your Twitter
so.
Handle?
I think it's at Charlie B Gate, I think. My name's Charlie Bathgate, so at Charlie B Gate, I want to say is what it is. I'm around. We're actually working on some stuff education wise. It's gonna be more psychologically oriented and I'll have more of a sort of active role in the public face of things with that stuff. Check out the websites. Obviously Lucci, all his stuff is always tied into what we're doing together. So check out Sang Lucci.
And when you come back, I want to talk about what we talked about today, but I want to hear how you're applying that to trading and how you're applying it to the markets. I was gonna start to ask you about that now, but it's a deep hole to go down. And
right.
so I think this
right.
is a good introduction to Charlie Bathgate. And I think that's what we'll talk about next time, because I want to know kind of how this enlightenment that you found has played into what you guys do when it comes to psychology and when it comes to trading. Because as you know, I know, Lucci knows, we've talked about so much of the trading game is mental. A lot of it is.
So
I'd be interested to know where you've broken new ground. But let's save that for a couple of weeks. And
sounds good.
Let's, you know, we've made our 500 donuts for the day. Maybe we hit the time clock now and we come back in a couple weeks, we'll make 500 more. How does that sound?
That sounds great, man.
All right,
well,
Charlie Bathgate, thank
really
you so much,
it,
brother. Yep, appreciate having you
Thanks,
on.
Thanks, Chris.
Take care.
All right.
That was Charlie Bathgate from sanglucci.com. Damn. Man, got a lot more questions for him. We're going to do it again, me and him. But as for right now, it is Tuesday, it's 6:10 p.m., and I have shit to do, so I am out. Thank you again to my patrons. I'm back from Vegas now. New podcast coming. I got a couple of great more other blip, blip, blip. Hello, idiot. Nice job talking. See what happens when you sit in the desert for 2 weeks? I have a couple of great guests already booked, and one that I'm trying to book that would really be fantastic if I could get it done. But for now, I'm the fuck out of here. Peace!